The Earth Wolflings had recorded in action their opposition to the arrival of Gubru Mite. Unexpectedly, they had done it with meticulous attention to the protocols of war. "They may be more than mere clever beasts, more than beasts. Perhaps they and their client should be studied, studied. Zoom." That gesture of resistance by the tiny Earthling flotilla meant that the suzerain would have to remain perched for at least the initial part of the occupation. It would have to find an excuse now, the sort of casus belli that would let the Gubru proclaim to the five galaxies that the Earthling's lease on Garth was null and void. Until that happened, the rules of war applied, and in enforcing them, the suzerain of propriety knew there would be conflicts with the other two commanders, its future lovers and competitors. Correct policy demanded tension among them, even if some of the laws the priest had to enforce struck it, deep down, as stupid. "Oh, for the time, may it be soon, soon when we are released from rules. Zoon. Soon when change rewards the virtuous, when the progenitors return. Zoon." The suzerain fluttered its downy coat. It commanded one of its servitors, a fluffy, imperturbable quacku, to bring a feather blower and groomer. "The Earthlings will stumble. They will give us justification. Zoon." Chapter 12. Athoclena. That morning, Athoclena could tell that something had happened the night before. But Robert said little in answer to her questions. His crude but effective empathy shield blocked her attempts at kenning. Athoclena tried not to feel insulted. After all, her human friend had only just begun learning to use his modest talents. He could not know the many subtle ways an empath could use to show a desire for privacy. Robert only knew how to close the door completely. Breakfast was quiet. When Robert spoke, she answered in monosyllables. Logically, Athoclena could understand his guardedness, but then there was no rule that said she had to be outgoing either. Low clouds crested the ridgelines that morning, to be sliced by rows of serrated spine stones. It made for an eerie, foreboding scene. They hiked through the tattered wisps of brumous fog in silence, gradually climbing higher in the foothills leading toward the mountains of Mulun. The air was still and seemed to carry a vague tension Athoclena could not identify. It tugged at her mind, drawing forth unbeckoned memories. She recalled a time when she had accompanied her mother into the northern mountains on Timbrim, riding Gervalback up a trail only slightly wider than this one, to attend a ceremony of uplift for the Taitlal. Uther Calding had been away on a diplomatic mission, and nobody knew yet what type of transport her father would be able to use for his return trip. It was an all-important question, for if he was able to come all the way via A-level hyperspace and transfer points, he could return home in 100 days or less. If forced to travel by D-level, or worse, normal space, Uther Calding might be away for the rest of their natural lives. The diplomatic service tried to inform its officers' families as soon as these matters were clear, but on this occasion they had taken far too long. Athoclena and her mother had started to become public nuisances, throwing irksome anxiety shimmers all over their neighborhood. At that point it had been politely hinted that they ought to get out of the city for a while. The service offered them tickets to go watch the representatives of the Taitlal undergo another rite of passage on the long path of uplift. Robert's slick mind shield reminded her of Mathakluwana's closely guarded pain during that slow ride into purple frosted hills. Mother and daughter hardly spoke to each other at all as they passed through broad fallow parklands and at last arrived at the grassy plain of an ancient volcano caldera. There, near a solitary symmetrical hilltop, thousands of Timbrimi had gathered near a swarm of brightly colored canopies to witness the acceptance and choice of the Taitlal. Observers had come from many distinguished star-faring clans. Scythians, Khantan, Mirg Four Luargi, and, of course, a gaggle of Kakinitas humans. The Earthlings mixed with their Timbrimi allies down near the refreshment tables, making a boisterous high time of it. She remembered her attitude then, upon seeing so many of the atrichic Brahmapnian creatures. Was I really such a snob? Athaclena wondered. She had sniffed disdainfully at the noise the humans made with their loud, low laughter. Their strange, applanate stares were everywhere as they strutted about displaying their bulging muscles. Even their females looked like caricatures of Timbrimi weightlifters. Of course, Athaclena had barely embarked on adolescence back on that day. Now, on reflection, she recalled that her own people were just as enthusiastic and flamboyant as the humans, waving their hands intricately and sparking the air with brief, flashing glyphs. This was, after all, a great day, for the Taitlal were to choose their patrons and their new uplift sponsors. Various dignitaries rested under the bright canopies. Of course, the immediate patrons of the Timbrimi, the Kaltmoor, could not attend, being tragically extinct. But their colors and sigil were in view, in honor of those who had given the Timbrimi the gift of sapience. Those present were honored, however, by a delegation of the chattering, stalk-legged Brimma, who had uplifted the Kaltmoor long, long ago. Athaclena remembered gasping, her corona crackling in surprise, when she saw that another shape curled under a dark brown covering, high upon the ceremonial mount. It was a Kralnith. The senior-most race in their patron line had sent a representative. The Kralnith were nearly torpid by now, having given over most of their waning enthusiasm to strange forms of meditation. It was commonly assumed they would not be around many more epochs. It was an honor to have one of them attend and offer its blessing to the latest members of their clan. Of course, it was the Taitlal themselves who were the center of attention. Wearing short silvery robes, they nonetheless looked much like those earth creatures known as otters. The Taitlal legatees fairly radiated pride as they prepared for their latest rite of uplift.
"Look," Athaclena's mother had pointed. "The Taitlal have elected their muse poet, Sustruk, to represent them. Do you recall meeting him, Athaclena?"
Naturally, she remembered. It had been only the year before when Sustruk visited their home back in the city. Uthakalding had brought the Taitlal genius by to meet his wife and daughter, shortly before he was to leave on his latest mission.
"Sustruk's poetry is simple-minded doggerel," Athaclena muttered.
Mathakluwana looked at her sharply. Then her corona waved. The glyph she crafted was Ch'Chakwan, the dark mirror only your own mother knew how to hold up before you. Athaclena's resentment reflected back at her, easily seen for what it was. She looked away, shamed. It was, after all, unfair to blame the poor Taitlal for reminding her of her absent father. The ceremony was indeed beautiful,
a glyph choir of Timbrimi from the colony world Juthtath, performed The Apotheosis of Larencini, and even the bare-pated humans stared in slack-jawed awe, obviously kenning some of the intricate floating harmonies. Only the bluff, impenetrable Thenanin ambassador seemed untouched, and they did not seem to mind at all being left out. After that, the Brimma singer Cuff-Cuffed crooned an ancient atonal paean to the progenitors. One bad moment for Athoclena came when the hushed audience listened to a composition specially created for the occasion by one of the 12 great dreamers of Earth, the whale named Five Bubble Spirals. While whales were not officially sentient beings, that fact did not keep them from being honored treasures. That they dwelled on Earth under the care of wolfling humans was one more cause for resentment by some of the more conservative galactic clans. Athoclena recalled sitting down and covering her ears while everyone else swayed happily to the eerie cetacean music. To her, it was worse than the sound of houses falling. Mathecluana's glance conveyed her worry. "My strange daughter, what are we to do with you?" At least Athoclena's mother did not chide aloud or in glyph, embarrassing her in public. At last, to Athoclena's great relief, the entertainment ended. It was the turn of the Titlal delegation, the time of acceptance and choice. Led by Sustruk, their great poet, the delegation approached the supine Kralnith dignitary and bowed low. Then they made their allegiance to the Brimma representatives, and afterward expressed polite submissiveness to the humans and other patron-class alien visitors. The Timbrimi Master of Uplift received obeisance last. Sustruk and his consort, a Titlal scientist named Kihimik, stepped ahead of the rest of their delegation as the mated pair chosen above all others to be race representatives. Alternately, they replied as the Master of Uplift read a list of formal questions and solemnly noted their answers. Then the pair came under the scrutiny of the critics from the Galactic Uplift Institute. Thus far, it had been a perfunctory version of the fourth stage test of sentience, but now there was one more chance for the Titlal to fail. One of the Galactics focusing sophisticated instruments on Sustruk and Kihimik was a Soro, no friend of Athoclena's clan. Possibly the Soro was looking for an excuse, any excuse, to embarrass the Timbrimi by rejecting their clients. Discreetly buried under the caldera was equipment that had cost Athoclena's race plenty. Right now, the scrutiny of the Titlal was being cast all through the five galaxies. There was much to be proud of today, but also some potential for humiliation. Of course, Sustruk and Kihimik passed easily. They bowed low to each of the alien examiners. If the Soro examiner was disappointed, she did not show it. The delegation of furry, short-legged Titlal ambled up to a cleared circle at the top of the hill. They began to sing, swaying together in that queer, loose-limbed manner so common among the creatures of their native planet, that fallow world where they had evolved into pre-sentience, where the Timbrimi had found and adopted them for the long process of uplift. Technicians focused the amplifier, which would display for all those assembled, and billions on other worlds, the choice the Titlal had made. Underfoot, a deep rumbling told of powerful engines at work. Theoretically, the creatures could even decide to reject their patrons and abandon uplift altogether, though there were so many rules and qualifications that in practice it was almost never allowed. Anyway, nothing like that was expected on that day. The Timbrimi had excellent relations with their clients. Still, a dry, anxious rustling swept the crowd as the rite of acceptance approached completion. The swaying Taitlal moaned, and a low hum rose from the amplifier. Overhead, a holographic image took shape, and the crowd roared with laughter and approval. It was the face of a Timbrimi, of course, and one everyone recognized at once. Oshoyoy Thuna, trickster of the city of Foyon, who had included several Taitlal as helpers in some of his most celebrated jests. Of course, the Taitlal had reaffirmed the Timbrimi as their patrons, but choosing Oshoyoy Thuna as their symbol went far beyond that. It exclaimed the Taitlal's pride in what it really meant to be part of their clan. After the cheering and laughter died down, there remained only one part of the ceremony to finish. The selection of the stage consort, the species who would speak for the Taitlal during the next phase of their uplift. The humans, in their strange tongue, called it the Uplift Midwife. The stage consort had to be of a race outside of the Timbrimi's own clan, and while the position was mostly ceremonial, a consort could legally intervene on the new client species' behalf if the uplift process appeared to be in trouble. Wrong choices in the past had created terrible problems. No one had any idea what race the Taitlal had chosen. It was one of those rare decisions that even the most meddlesome patrons, such as the Soro, had to leave to their charges. Sustruk and Kihimik crooned once more, and even from her position at the back of the crowd, Athaklena could sense a growing feeling of anticipation rising from the furry little clients. The little devils had cooked up something, that was certain. Again the ground shuddered, the amplifier murmured once more, and holographic projectors formed a blue cloudiness over the crest of the hill. In it, there seemed to float murky shapes, flicking back and forth as if through backlit water. Her corona offered no clue, for the image was strictly visual. She resented the humans, their sharper eyesight, as a shout of surprise rose from the area where most of the earthlings had congregated. All around her, Timbrimi were standing up and staring. She blinked. Then Athaklena and her mother joined the rest in amazed disbelief. One of the murky figures flicked up to the foreground and stopped, grinning out at the audience, displaying a long, narrow grin of white, needle-sharp teeth. There was a glittering eye, and bubbles rose from its glistening gray brow. The stunned silence lengthened, for in all of Ifni's starfield, nobody had expected the Taitlal to choose dolphins. The visiting galactics were stricken dumb. Neo-dolphins. Why, the second client race of Earth were the youngest acknowledged sapients in all five galaxies, much younger than the Taitlal themselves. This was unprecedented. It was astonishing. It was hilarious. The Timbrimi cheered. Their laughter rose high and clear. As one, their coronae sparkled upward, a single coruscating glyph of approval, so vivid that even the Thenanin ambassador seemed to blink and take notice. Seeing that their allies weren't offended, the humans joined in, hooting and slapping their hands together with intimidating energy. Kihimik and most of the other assembled Taitlal bowed, accepting their patron's accolade. Good clients, it seemed, they had worked hard to come up with a fine jest for this important day. Only Sustruk himself stood rigid at the rear, still quivering from the strain. All around Athaklena crested waves of approval and joy.
She heard her mother's laughter, joining in with the others. But Athaclena herself had backed away, edging out of the cheering crowd, until there was room to turn and flee. In a full gear flux, she ran and ran until she passed the caldera's rim and could drop down the trail out of sight or sound. There, overlooking the beautiful valley of lingering shadows, she collapsed to the ground while the waves of enzyme reaction shook her.
That horrible dolphin!
Never since that day had she confided in anyone what she had seen in the eye of the imaged cetacean. Not to her mother, nor even her father, had she ever told the truth. That she had sensed, deep within that projected hologram, a glyph, one rising from Sustruck himself, the poet of the Titlo. Those present thought it was all a grand jest, a magnificent blag. They thought they knew why the Titlo had chosen the youngest race of Earth as their stage consort, to honor the clan with a grand and harmless joke. By choosing dolphins, they seemed to be saying that they needed no protector, that they loved and honored their Tim Brimmy patrons without reservation. And by selecting the humans' second clients, they also tweaked those stodgy old galactic clans who so disapproved of the Tim Brimmy's friendship with wolflings. It was a fine gesture. Delicious. Had Athaclena been the only one, then, to see the deeper truth? Had she imagined it? Many years later, on a distant planet, Athaclena shivered as she recalled that day. Had she been the only one to pick up Sustruck's third harmonic of laughter and pain and confusion? The muse poet died only days after that episode, and he took his secret with him to his grave. Only Athaclena seemed to sense that the ceremony had been no joke after all, that Sustruck's image had not come from his thoughts, but out of time. The Titlo had indeed chosen their protectors, and the choice was in desperate earnest. Now, only a few years later, the five galaxies had been sent into turmoil over certain discoveries made by a certain obscure client race, the youngest of them all, dolphins. Oh, Earthlings, she thought, as she followed Robert Heyer into the mountains of Mulan. What have you done? No, that was not the right question. What? Oh, what is it you are planning to become? That afternoon, the two wanderers encountered a steep field of plate ivy. A plain of glossy, wide-brimmed plants covered the southeastward slope of the ridge, like green overlapping scales on the flank of some great slumbering beast. Their path to the mountains was blocked.
I'll bet you're wondering how we'll get across all this to the other side, Robert asked. The slope looks treacherous, Athaclena ventured. And it stretches far in both directions. I suppose we'll have to turn around.
There was something in the fringes of Robert's mind, though, that made that seem unlikely.
These are fascinating plants, he said.
Squatting next to one of the plates, a shield-like inverted bowl almost 2 meters across, he grabbed its edge and yanked backward, hard. The plate stretched away from the tightly bound field until Athaclena could see a tough, springy root attached to its center. She moved closer to help him pull, wondering what he had in mind. The colony buds a new generation of these caps every few weeks, each layer overlapping the prior one, Robert explained as he grunted and tugged the fibrous root taut. In late autumn, the last layers of caps flower and become wafer thin. They break off and catch the strong winter winds, sailing into the sky, millions of them.
It's quite a sight, believe me. All those rainbow-colored kites drifting under the clouds, even if it is a hazard to flyers.
They are seeds, then? Athaklena asked.
Well, spore carriers, actually, and most of the pods that litter the Sindh in early winter are sterile. Seems the plate ivy used to rely on some pollinating creature that went extinct during the Burrali Holocaust. Just one more problem for the ecological recovery teams to deal with.
Robert shrugged.
Right now, though, in the springtime, these early caps are rigid and strong. It'll take some doing to cut one free.
Robert drew his knife and reached under to slice away at the taut fibers holding the cap down. The strips parted suddenly, releasing the tension and throwing Athaklena back with the bulky plate on top of her.
Oops, I'm sorry, Clenny.
She felt Robert's effort to suppress laughter as he helped her struggle out from under the heavy cap.
Just like a boy, Athaklena thought.
Are you okay?
I am fine,
she answered stiffly and dusted herself off. Tipped over, the plate's inner concave side looked like a bowl with a thick central stem of ragged, sticky strands.
Good. Then why don't you help me carry it over to that sandy bank near the drop-off?
The field of plate ivy stretched around the prominence of the ridge, surrounding it on three sides. Together, they hefted the detached cap over to where the bumpy green slope began, laying it inner face up. Robert set to work trimming the ragged interior of the plate. After a few minutes, he stood back and examined his handiwork.
This should do.
He nudged the plate with his foot.
Your father wanted me to show you everything I could about Garth. In my opinion, your education would be truly lacking if I never taught you to ride plate ivy.
Athaklena looked from the upended plate to the scree of slick caps.
Do you mean?
But Robert was already loading their gear into the upturned bowl.
You cannot be serious, Robert.
He shrugged, looking up at her sidelong.
We can backtrack a mile or two and find a way around all this if you like.
You aren't joking,
Athaklena sighed. It was bad enough that her father and her friends back home thought her too timid. She could not refuse a dare offered by this human.
Very well, Robert. Show me how it is done.
Robert stepped into the plate and checked its balance. Then he motioned for her to join him. She climbed into the rocking thing and sat where Robert indicated, in front of him, with her knees on either side of the central stump. It was then, with her corona waving in nervous agitation, that it happened again. Athaklena sensed something that made her convulsively clutch the rubbery sides of the plate, setting it rocking.
Hey, watch it, will you? You almost tipped us over.
Athaklena grabbed his arm while she scanned the valley below. All around her face, a haze of tiny tendrils fluttered.
I ken it again. It's down there, Robert, somewhere in the forest.
What? What's down there?
The entity I kenned earlier. The thing that was neither man nor chimpanzee. It was a little like either, and yet different, and it reeks with potential.
Robert shaded his eyes.
Where? Can you point to it?
Athaklena concentrated. She tried localizing the faint brush of emotions.
It is gone,
she sighed at last. Robert radiated nervousness.
Are you sure it wasn't just a chim?
There are lots of them up in these hills, sisin gatherers and conservation workers. Athaklena cast a palang glyph. Then, recalling that Robert wasn't likely to notice the sparkling essence of frustration, she shrugged
to indicate approximately the same nuance.
No, Robert. I have met many neo-chimpanzees, remember? The being I sensed was different. I'd swear it wasn't fully sapient, for one thing, and there was a feeling of sadness, of submerged power.
Athaclena turned to Robert, suddenly excited.
Can it have been a Garthling? Oh, let's hurry. We might be able to get closer.
She settled in around the center post and looked up at Robert expectantly. The famed Timbrimi adaptability, Robert sighed.
All of a sudden you're anxious to go. And here I'd been hoping to impress and arouse you with the white-knuckler ride. Boys, she thought again, shaking her head vigorously. How can they think such things, even in jest? Stop joking and let's be off, she urged.
He settled into the plate behind her. Athaclena held on tightly to his knees. Her tendrils waved about his face, but Robert did not complain. All right, here we go. His musty human aroma was close around her as he pushed off, and the plate began to slip forward. It all came back to Robert as their makeshift sled accelerated, skidding and bouncing over the slick convex caps of plate ivy. Athaclena gripped his knees tightly, her laughter higher and more bell-like than a human girl's. Robert, too, laughed and shouted, holding Athaclena as he leaned one way and then the other, to steer the madly hopping sled.
Must have been 11 years old when I did this last.
Every jounce and leap made his heart pound. Not even an amusement park gravity ride was like this. Athaclena let out a squeak of exhilaration as they sailed free and landed again with a rubbery rebound. Her corona was a storm of silvery threads that seemed to crackle with excitement.
I only hope I remember how to control this thing right.
Maybe it was his rustiness, or it might have been Athaclena's presence distracting him, but Robert was just a little late reacting when the near oak stump, a remnant of the forest that had once grown on this slope, loomed suddenly in their path. Athaclena laughed in delight as Robert leaned hard to the left, swerving their crude boat wildly. By the time she sensed his sudden change of mood, their spin was already a tumble out of control. Then their plate caught on something unseen. Impact swerved them savagely, sending the contents of the sled flying. At that moment, luck and Timbrimi instincts were with Athaclena. Stress hormones surged and reflexes tucked her head down, rolling her into a ball. On impact, her body made its own sled, bouncing and skidding atop the plates like a rubbery ball. It all happened in a blur. Giant's fists struck her, tossed her about. A great roar filled her ears, and her corona blazed as she spun and fell again and again. Finally, Athaclena tumbled to a halt, still curled up tight, just short of the forest on the valley floor. At first, she could only lie there as the gear enzymes made her pay the price for her quick reflexes. Breath came in long, shuddering gasps. Her high and low kidneys throbbed, struggling with the sudden overload. And there was pain. Athaclena had trouble localizing it. She seemed only to have picked up a few bruises and scrapes. So where... Realization came in a rush as she uncurled and opened her eyes. The pain was coming from Robert. Her earthling guide was broadcasting blinding surges of agony. She got up gingerly, still dizzy from reaction, and shaded her eyes to look around the bright hillside. The human wasn't in sight, so she sought him with her corona. The searing pain flood led her stumbling awkwardly over the glossy plates to a point not far from the upended sled. Robert's legs kicked weakly from under a layer of broad plate ivy caps. An effort to back out culminated in a low, muffled moan. A sparkling shower of hot agonies seemed to home right in on Athoclena's corona. She knelt beside him.
"Robert, are you caught on something? Can you breathe?"
What foolishness, she realized, asking multiple questions when she could tell the human was barely even conscious.
"I must do something."
Athoclena drew her jack laser from her boot top and attacked the plate ivy, starting well away from Robert, slicing stems and grunting as she heaved aside the caps one at a time. Knotty, musky vines remained tangled around the human's head and arms, pinning him to the thicket.
"Robert, I'm going to cut near your head. Don't move."
Robert groaned, something indecipherable. His right arm was badly twisted, and so much distilled ache fizzed around him that she had to withdraw her corona to keep from fainting from the overload. Aliens weren't supposed to commune this strongly with Timbrimmy. At least, she had never believed it possible before this. Robert gasped as she heaved the last shriveled cap away from his face. His eyes were closed and his mouth moved as if he were silently talking to himself.
"What is he doing now?"
She felt the overtones of some obviously human rite of discipline. It had something to do with numbers and counting. Perhaps it was that self-hypnosis technique all humans were taught in school. Though primitive, it seemed to be doing Robert some good.
"I'm going to cut away the roots binding your arm now," she told him.
He jerked his head in a nod.
"Hurry, Clenny. I've never had to block this much pain before."
He let out a shivering sigh as the last rootlet parted. His arm sprang free, floppy and broken.
"What now?"
Athoclena worried. It was always hazardous to interfere with an injured member of an alien race. Lack of training was only part of the problem. One's most basic succoring instincts might be entirely wrong for helping someone of another species. Athoclena grabbed a handful of coronal tendrils and twisted them in indecision.
"Some things have to be universal."
Make sure the victim keeps breathing. That she had done automatically. Try to stop leaks of bodily fluids. All she had to go on were some old pre-contact movies she and her father had watched on the journey to Garth, dealing with ancient Earth creatures called cops and robbers. According to those films, Robert's wounds might be called only scratches, but she suspected those ancient story records weren't particularly strong on realism.
"Oh, if only humans weren't so frail!"
Athoclena rushed to Robert's backpack, seeking the radio in the lower side pouch. Aid could arrive from Port Helenia in less than an hour, and rescue officials could tell her what to do in the meantime. The radio was simple, of Timbrimmy design, but nothing happened when she touched the power switch.
"No, it has to work."
She stabbed it again, but the indicator stayed blank. Athoclena popped the back cover. The transmitter crystal had been removed. She blinked in consternation. How could this be? They were cut off from help. She was completely on her own.
"Robert,"
she said as she knelt by him again,
"you must guide me. I cannot help you unless you tell me what to do."
The human still counted from 1 to 10, over and over. She had to repeat herself until at last his eyes came into focus.
I think my arm's busted, Clenny," he gasped. "Help get me out of the sun, then use drugs."
His presence seemed to fade away, and his eyes rolled up as unconsciousness overcame him. Athoclena did not approve of a nervous system that overloaded with pain, leaving its owner unable to help himself. It wasn't Robert's fault. He was brave, but his brain had shorted out. There was one advantage, of course. Fainting damped down his broadcast agony. That made it easier for her to drag him backward over the spongy, uneven field of plate ivy, attempting all the while not to shake his broken right arm unduly.
Big-boned, huge-thewed, over-muscled human.
She cast a glyph of great pungency as she pulled his heavy body all the way to the shady edge of the forest. Athaclena retrieved their backpacks and quickly found Robert's first aid kit. There was a tincture she had seen him use only 2 days before, when he had caught his finger on a wood sliver. This she slathered liberally over his lacerations. Robert moaned and shifted a little. She could feel his mind struggle upward against the pain. Soon, half automatically, he was mumbling numbers to himself once again. Her lips moved as she read the Anglic instructions on a container of flesh foam. Then she applied the sprayer onto his cuts, sealing them under a medicinal layer. That left the arm, and the agony. Robert had mentioned drugs, but which drugs? There were many little ampules, clearly labeled in both Anglic and Gal 7, but directions were sparse. There was no provision for a non-Terran having to treat a human without benefit of advice. She used logic. Emergency medicines would be packaged in gas ampules for easy, quick administration. Athaclena pulled out 3 likely-looking glassine cylinders. She bent forward until the silvery strands of her corona fell around Robert's face, bringing close his human aroma, musty, and, in this case, so very male.
"Robert," she whispered carefully in Anglic, "I know you can hear me. Rise within yourself. I need your wisdom out in the here and now."
Apparently, she was only distracting him from his rite of discipline, for she sensed the pain increase. Robert grimaced and counted out loud. Timbrimi do not curse as humans do. A purist would say they make stylistic statements of record instead. But at times like this, few would be able to tell the difference. Athaclena muttered caustically in her native tongue. Clearly, Robert was not an adept, even at this crude self-hypnosis technique. His pain pummeled the fringes of her mind, and Athaclena let out a small trill, like a sigh. She was unaccustomed to having to keep out such an assault. The fluttering of her eyelids blurred vision as would a human's tears. There was only one way, and it meant exposing herself more than she was accustomed, even with her family. The prospect was daunting, but there didn't seem to be any choice. In order to get through to him at all, she had to get a lot closer than this.
I am here, Robert. Share it with me.
She opened up to the narrow flood of sharp, discreet agonies, so un-Timbrimi and yet so eerily familiar, almost as if they were recognizable somehow. The quanta of agony dripped to an uneven pump beat. They were little hot, searing balls, lumps of molten metal.
Lumps of metal?
The weirdness almost startled Athaclena out of contact. She had never before experienced a metaphor so vividly. It was more than just a comparison, stronger than saying that one thing was like another. For a moment, the agonies had been glowing iron globs that burned to touch.
To be human is strange indeed.
Athaclena tried to ignore the imagery. She moved toward the agony nexus until a barrier stopped her.
Another metaphor?
This time it was a swiftly flowing stream of pain, a river that lay across her path.
What she needed was an unsultlan, a protection field to carry her up the flood to its source, but
How did one shape the mind stuff of a human?